For a second, Dave, I thought you were following them out then. Go upstairs and do a bit of colouring in. Excuse me. You turn with me to Genesis chapter 12, please. I'm going to be reading Genesis 12 from verses 1 to 9. Now the Lord said to Abram, "Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." So Abram went as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. And Abram took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their possessions that they had gathered, and the people that they had acquired in Haran, and they set out to go to the land of Canaan. When they came to the land of Canaan, Abram passed through the land to the place at Shechem, to the oak of Moreh. At that time, the Canaanites were in the land. Then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, "To your offspring I will give this land." So he built an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him. From there he moved to the hill country on the east of Bethel and pitched his tent with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. And there he built an altar to the Lord and called upon the name of the Lord. And Abram journeyed on, still going towards the Negev. This is Abram who later became Abraham. We generally remember him as Abraham, and later on God does actually change his name for him. In his commentary on the book of Genesis, the Bible teacher James Montgomery Boyce wrote, "With the exception of Jesus Christ, Abraham is probably the most important person in the Bible." That's a pretty big statement. Up to this point, there have been 11 chapters of Genesis, okay? And they've covered around 2,000 years of history, give or take. So this is a proper whistle-stop tour through history from the Garden of Eden up to this point. And then we have about 13 whole chapters dedicated to the life of this one man. What he did and what God did through him and what God promised him. And then a further 10 chapters detailing the life of his son and his grandson. So this would indicate that he's pretty significant. This guy is quite important. Or more importantly, what God decided to do through him is important. And I think it's fair to say you can't understand the Old Testament without understanding Abraham and his story. And you can't understand the New Testament without understanding the Old Testament. And in particular, the story of Abraham. And if you look at the book of Genesis, you see if you look at the New Testament, you see his story repeatedly being written about and spoken about. The fact that this story is so central to God's salvation history and God's work is clear from how important it is to the New Testament writers. Now, I've said many times, I realize that my attempt to do a series through Genesis has been very sporadic, and a lot of the time I'm not preaching nowadays anyway, but as I've gradually worked through to this point, I've said again and again, Genesis is the book of beginnings, and in it we see the beginning of many things that permeate throughout the Bible. Run all the way through the Bible, and things happen here that impact everything else in the Bible, and things happen here that make sense of everything else in the Bible. So here in chapter 12, we see the beginning of the unfolding of the whole gospel message, which culminates in the work of Christ. This is where the gospel message really kind of begins. We've had suggestions of grace, we've had the fall, we've had God making promises and things like that. But then when it comes to the actual gospel message, this is where it begins. And we generally think of the gospel message as a New Testament thing. But right back at the beginning, this is where you find the seeds of the gospel. And everything else that unfolds in the Bible is a consequence of the promises that God makes to Abraham. So he's enormously significant. If you want to find, if you were to sort of hand a Bible to somebody who didn't really know much about God and didn't really know much about the gospel and didn't really have much of an understanding. Obviously, if they wanted to know about Jesus, you point to the gospels first. But if they said, look, I've heard about this salvation by grace, right? This salvation by faith alone. And only faith can get us salvation and nothing else. And only grace offered by God gives us an opportunity for salvation. Where would I look to find out more about that in particular? And the most important places you could point them to, if that was what they wanted to know, would be the books of Romans and Galatians. Right? They are like the sort of supercharged gospel message, salvation by grace alone, through faith alone. That's what those two books are just about. And in those two books, chapter 4 of Romans is all about Abraham. And chapter 3 of Galatians is all about Abraham. And then you get him being repeatedly referred to in the Gospels and in the book of Acts. And Hebrews chapter 11, which is a chapter all about the importance and the power of faith, Abraham keeps on cropping up in Hebrews 11. So he's everywhere in the New Testament. Everywhere. And throughout the Old Testament, people keep on referring to God as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Right? Is that God we're talking about? Realize I'm laboring the point a little bit, but this guy is very important, and we need to understand him and get to grips with the importance of his life. So here we begin the account of Abraham, or Abram, as he's first known. As he's first being called by God, and he's been given these incredible promises. So in verses 1 through 3, we see God's promises and God's requirements. His promises and his requirements in something that's known as the covenant of grace. Okay, the covenant of grace. And it's the covenant of grace that runs all through the Bible. And it's never actually called that in the Bible, the covenant of grace. But covenant is a very, very prominent idea in the Old Testament. Another word for covenant is testament. Covenant and testament were sort of interchangeable words back in, you know, way back in the old days. Like last will and testament, or Old Testament, New Testament. Because they are the books of the Old Covenant and the New Covenant. And that's the name that's sort of stuck with. But it could, when the Bible was first translated into English back in 1300, or whenever it was, 1400 something, I think. When it was first translated, that's the title that was chosen. We're going to call this bit the Old Testament or Old Covenant, and this bit the New Testament or the New Covenant. One thing that comes through loud and clear when we're learning about this covenant, where it begins here, is that all our happiness and all our fulfillment and all our sense of fulfillment in God, all our sense of connection with God, comes through this covenant of grace. And we're often pulled away from it. We're often pulled away from it by ourselves, by the enemy. We're often sort of led to believe, well, you know, if I want to really be happy, like, you know, church is okay and everything, but if I really want to be happy, I'm going to just pursue what I want to pursue. And God can sort of stay on the back burner a bit. God can just kind of stay over there a bit, and I'll do my thing, and then I'll go to church on Sunday. And I might occasionally pick my Bible up and stuff. And the world is very, 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 very big on this idea that, all right, you believe what you believe, and I'll believe what I believe, but at the same time, you know, if you really want to have a good time, if you really want to be fulfilled, you've got to love the same things that we love. You've got to do the same things that we do. You've got to get your priorities right. And your priorities should be our priorities. But it's very clear, as you read these promises, that happiness and contentment and satisfaction and fulfillment come from dying to ourselves and living for God. Dying to ourselves and living for Christ. You know, in Galatians, I have been crucified with Christ. It's no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. And that message is just as important for us today as it was to Abram. So here in verses 1 through 3, we see two things. We see the commands of the covenant of grace, and we see the promises of the covenant of grace. And You know, it's a little bit of a tightrope to walk because we don't believe in what some people call hypergrace, where you can do anything you want and it doesn't matter and everybody's saved. And it doesn't matter whether or not, you know, you get this Christian universalism thing. So we don't believe in that hypergrace when everything goes and it doesn't matter and God's going to forgive you no matter what. But also we don't believe that your works are what save you. So it looks a little bit awkward and we say, well, you know, there are requirements, there are things you have to do. And it's a knife edge. It's such a, this is why Jesus said there's a narrow path and there's a wide path. We'll get to that in a minute. So, what we see first is a covenant or agreement is always mutual. A covenant is like a contract. It's like an agreement. Okay? And a covenant is always mutual. There have to be two or more parties in a covenant. You have to have a couple of different parties coming together and agreeing on things. And there may be promises that are made by God and established by God, but there's always an obligation. We have an obligation. It's a relationship, and it's a life and death relationship. And it comes with mutual obligations. God will do things, but there are things we need to do as well. And sometimes people will single out this covenant and say, it was unconditional. But if you look at it, it wasn't. It wasn't unconditional at all. Because there are requirements for him. Look at the very first words. Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. So this is the call. In fact, you know, chapter 12 is headed in my Bible, the call to what? The call of Abram. And it may well be in yours as well. Go from your country. Leave everything. Get up and go. The first words of the covenant of grace are commands. They're commandments. And God gives these requirements. And if you look further down, there's another requirement. And in our translation, it doesn't look like one. But it is one. At the end of verse 2, it says, you will be a blessing. You will be a blessing. And that sounds to us like something that's just going to happen. They say, go, and you'll be a blessing. And it'll be great. Go, off you go, and you'll be a blessing. But if, apparently in the Hebrew, I don't read Hebrew, but I rely on commentaries and things like that. Apparently in the Hebrew, that's what's known as an imperative. It's a command. Go and be a blessing. It's not you'll be a blessing because stuff will just happen. It's I want you to be a blessing. He's commanded to go and be a blessing. So these are the commands to him. Go and be a blessing. And those are the commands of the covenant of grace. He's told by God to go from his country, from his relatives, from his father's house, from everything that he knows, and to be a blessing. And isn't it interesting that the covenant of grace begins with God telling Abraham, separate yourself. Separate yourself from everything that you know for the time being. And the book of Genesis has been kind of zooming in on this man Abraham. It's been narrowing our focus down and down and down and down. Because we've seen the creation of everything, and then we've seen the garden, and then we've seen descendants of Adam and Eve, and we've seen nations, and we've seen families built, and we've seen bloodlines, and we've seen the flood, and we've seen all these big events and all these big characters and all these big people, and sometimes very significant people's lives are covered in like one or two lines. And hardly anybody, apart from Adam, Eve, and Noah, hardly anybody has much print dedicated to them. And then as it's zeroing in and in and in and in, it's like we've got, you know, whole lives being mentioned in two or three words. And then we get to this point where we go, right, here's this man who will become Abraham. And we're now going to spend 13 chapters looking at his whole life. And he's the first person who has a massive chunk of time viewed in the Bible. And over these 13 or so chapters, we'll see God's plan gradually revealed in his life and through him. And this call to separation, it doesn't mean that he's to take himself completely out of the world and have no association with it, okay? This idea of like a going off to a monastery or something, or, you know, the old desert fathers in the 4th, 5th, 6th centuries, they'd go off into the desert and they'd just be like these crazy people living in isolation, a bit like John the Baptist, but wouldn't have anything to do with anyone. You know, eating locusts and things and shouting at strangers. And they had this idea, if I completely separate myself off from the world and have nothing to do with anyone, I'll be holy. Well, how can you be holy? If the book of James says, you know, show me your faith without your works. No? You know the one. I really should remember that, shouldn't you? Show me your faith. Yes. Show me your faith without your works, and I'll show you my faith by my works. Your faith manifests in the transformation that takes place in your life and the things that you do. It's unbelievable I couldn't remember that one then. Don't tell anyone, all right? No, yes, it is. This is one of those bits where I say I'll cut it out of the recording and then it still ends up in the recording, but, you know, these things happen. He's not telling him, cut yourself off from the world. Because the second command is, be a blessing. So on the one hand, he's separate, and on the other hand, be a blessing. And we have this kind of tension in the middle of it. And isn't that precisely what Jesus tells us to do when he calls us to be salt and light? He's saying, be different from the world, but be a blessing to the world. Be separate from the world, but bless the nations, he's telling Abraham. And here God calls himself to separate himself from country and father and family to be a blessing to everyone. And as Christians, we need to see ourselves as different from the world. And we need to see ourselves as in a sense, separate from the world. And have different priorities and have different goals and have different agendas. And not in any way so that we can feel better than anyone else and feel superior to anyone else. Because we know that you can't have faith in Jesus Christ and his power to save you from sin if you don't accept that you're a sinner first. So he's not to despise the world and separate himself from the world, and we're not supposed to either. But we must say no to the world so that we can say yes to the world. We have to distance ourselves from the world in a sense, so that we can reach out to the world. And this isn't something that we've cooked up ourselves. It's something that we've had in the call of God. And it's his agenda and it's his priority and his goal and his worldview should be our focus and our desire. And he calls us to be distinct from the world in order to be a blessing. And that's the challenge of the Christian life. And this is the first time that you see it in the Word of God. So we've seen these two commands. Now that we've seen the commands, we'll look at the promises. These are the promises of the covenant that were made to Abraham. And there are six of them in chapter 12. And these are expanded on in the rest of his story and the rest of the Bible. The first promise is that he's going to make him a great nation. I'll make you a great nation. Now, his name at this point means exalted father. Abraham means exalted father. And it's a bit of an irony because just before this in chapter 11, we're told Sarai, his wife, is barren. But we're told Sarai was barren. She had no child. Of course she had no child if she was barren. But it's emphasizing it because it wants us to take notice of this. His wife could not bear children. They had no children. God is saying, take notice of this. It's important. Because in a couple of verses, I'm going to promise him he's going to be a father of a great nation. There was a promise of offspring for Abram and Sarai. And then God said, I will bless you. I will bless you. He's to be the object of a special blessing, special saving favor from the Lord. He's singled out to receive this promise. And not anything, not a promise that's based on how good Abram is, because there's evidence that he came from a background that was involved in idol worship. He was probably an idolater. He was probably a very sinful man. And yet, somehow, God has plucked him out and said, in spite of what you are, and in spite of what you have done, I can offer you hope and blessing and salvation. Isn't that amazing? In spite of, not because of. In spite of what you are, I will save you. In spite of what you are, I will bless you, and I will love you, and I will make you promises. And then God says, I will make your name great. I will make your name great. Now, earlier in Genesis 11, the Tower of Babel, Okay? I was going to preach on the Tower of Babel, but I couldn't cobble together a sermon out of it. I'll be honest with you, I just couldn't do it. I'm just not smart enough. So we just jumped over the Tower of Babel. But the Tower of Babel, okay, in there it says, the people of Babel, they said, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven, and let us make for ourselves a name. They wanted to make a name for themselves. They wanted to be known. They wanted to be glorified. They wanted everybody to think that they were special. So God came down and said, no, 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 no. No, no, no. I don't think so. And he scattered them. He confused their language and he scattered them over the face of the earth. God brought them to nothing because of their pride. But God brings down the proud and he exalts the humble. Isn't that amazing? So what does he say to Abram? He says, I will make your name great, and it will be because of me, not because of you. Then he promises, I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you, I will curse. So it's protection. It's a sense of protection. Now the fifth blessing is, in you all the families of the earth will be blessed. And again, now we see the focus of the nations. We see a focus not on Abram, but on the greater work that God will do. And in a sense, this is a strange promise. Not a strange promise. This promise almost kind of disappears for a while. This drops off the radar a bit. Because from Abram, he goes on and he founds the nation of Israel and he blesses Israel and they're separate from the world. And you know, a lot of the book of Leviticus is about how they're supposed to be different to everybody else. And you know, you get the holiness code where you got all these things that kind of don't make sense to us at first. Like, you mustn't eat shellfish and you mustn't wear clothes made of any more than one kind of cloth. I'm going, what? Is it okay that I've got different kinds of cloth on at the moment? But this is just, that was all about God saying, you will be different to everyone else in ways that they notice. Not because wearing different kinds of cloth is bound for your salvation, but because people must notice how different you are. And he separated off the nation of Israel. So in a sense, this promise kind of fizzled into the background a bit. And then the New Testament came and go out into all the world, make disciples of everybody. And this promise then returned in power. You know, the Holy Spirit descended on everyone, Jews and Gentiles alike. So he said, you will be a blessing to all the families of the earth. And then finally, and it's hinted at in verse 1, he says, go forth from your country to the land I will show you, okay? There's a hint there, but then in verse 7, God says to Abraham, to your descendants I will give this land. I will give this land. And this kind of plays out then, you know, later in the book of Exodus when the Jews are free from Israel and they go into the promised land. And this is the land that was promised to Abraham at first, the land of Canaan, you know, they take to Egypt and all of that. But then when they go off to the promised land, this is the one they're going to. Abraham, I've promised your descendants this land, but it's not going to happen for about, I think about 500 years, something like that. Probably more like 600 years after Abraham. So these are the six promises of the covenant of grace, which we see explained and unfolded in the rest of the Old and the New Testament. Next, if you look at verses 4 and 5, you'll see this separation being worked out, because the call of the covenant of grace, as I've said, is about separation. That call is about separating ourselves. And when we're called by God to come after him, it's a call to put behind us all of the things of our old life. And to continue to put those things behind us and away from us. Because the covenant requires loyalty. Loyalty to God. Which says, God is my first priority. God is the one who sets the agenda. God is the one who sets my priorities and my preferences. God is the one who is in charge of telling me what I should pursue. What should be important to me. And it's seen very clearly in the life of Abraham. If you look at verse 4, it says, so Abraham went forth as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. And I mean, this is a drum that I keep on banging, but obviously for the sake of space and because the style of writing was so different back then, you'll get something enormous in the Bible that is dealt with in just a few words. You know, in the Gospels, you've got Jesus on the cross and then he died. And if that was written in a modern style now, you'd have pages and pages. You know, the episode of Jesus on the cross would fill up pages and pages of a modern writing of this. But it just says, so Abram went forth as the Lord had told him. Off he went. Now, people didn't do that in this day and age. People didn't just up sticks and go, right? Especially when they were 75. He's 75 here, the poor guy. And God has said to him, right, where you're living at the moment, because where he lived at the time, it wasn't a desert, it was fertile, it was green, you had pomegranates and apples and berries and wildlife and rivers and greenery and good farming and everything, and it was a wonderful place. And he had his family and he had the people that he loved and he had his community and his relatives and he built a life. And he's 75 years old and he's starting to think, it's time to put my feet up soon. And God said, I want you to go into the desert that is potentially hostile and very dangerous. I want you to leave behind everybody you know and everybody you love. And by the way, you're not going to be able to write to them or phone them or email them, because that doesn't happen for the next couple of thousand years. And I want you to go out into a place where there's no law and no government and no infrastructure and no running water and no medicine and no anything. And I want you to cut yourself from all of the support and all of the special things that you've surrounded yourself with for your whole life. And I want you to up sticks and just go. Go to the land I'll show you. It's a tall order. You know, I'd find it hard if God said to me, get up and go off and live in, you know, move to Bristol. And I go, oh, but I like it here. I'll have to go from this house here and go to that house there. But he said to Abraham, he said, get a tent and go off into the desert. So he went and he separated himself about as much as it's possible to separate yourself. And he took Sarai, his wife, and he took Lot, his nephew. Probably took Lot because at this time he didn't have children. He didn't have a physical heir. Okay? So he probably took Lot to inherit everything that he had after his days. He probably took him as his heir. Lost my paper. So Lot is taken along for this purpose, and now they've separated themselves off. And this begins the process of God's work in his life. And if you look at verses 6 and 7, you'll see this amazing passage of God's covenant of grace with Abraham. In verses 6 and 7, this Abraham, this man, he's a stranger in a strange land, okay? He's out and he's wandering and he's cut off. And he doesn't exactly know where he's going or what he's doing or what God's planning to do. And he probably wandered for years. You know, it says, oh, he got up and he went and he went over there. But he had to move everything he had, and he had to move all his servants and everything. And there he is, a stranger in a strange land. And he declares the Lord's dominion in a place of idols. Right? Because this is what happens. It said, he passed through the land as far as the site of Shechem. That phrase, the site of Shechem, seems to indicate that there was a Canaanite shrine there to their false gods. There was a temple of some sort or an altar. It was a place of worship to a false god. And God took him right there and appeared to him there in a place of false idol worship and said, I will give you this land. Because at the moment it belongs to these people and they think it belongs to these idols. But I will give you this land. And it's a hugely important site in the redemptive history. I mean, it appears in Deuteronomy 27. There's the whole episode of where God sent people onto opposite mountains, what they called Ebal and Gerizim, and they were shouting curses and blessings backwards and forwards. It was the site where Joshua, he was Moses' successor, he gave his final address to the people of God. It was here that Solomon's kingdom was divided up, and all these important events sort of intersected at this one place. But the first time we see it mentioned is when God brought Abraham there, and in the shadow of this shrine, God promised, I will give your descendants this land, because this does not belong to the Canaanites and it does not belong to their idols. It's like a defiant declaration of God's dominion that he extends everywhere and he is the one true God. And then in verses 8 and 9 we see his pilgrimage. You know, responding to the covenant means being a stranger. It means being a stranger in a strange land. You know, we are strangers and aliens. And it means being this pilgrim. And it says in verses 8 and 9, from there he moved to the hill country on the east of Bethel and pitched his tent with Bethel on the east and Ai on Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. And there he built an altar to the Lord and called upon the name of the Lord. And that phrase, called upon the name of the Lord, it refers to corporate worship. They all came together and they worshipped. Whether they sang, I don't know what it was, but it was a gathering, a worship gathering with him and his servants and his wife and his nephew in the midst of this pagan land. And you'll notice two things are mentioned here. Look at what he did in verse 8. He pitched his tent. But before the corporate worship, he built an altar. Now, he's got a tent which he's got to pick up and carry off with him everywhere he goes, and it's impermanent. But he wanted an altar there as a solid reminder. This belongs to the Lord. He put down an altar. This belongs to the Lord, you know. And it shows his priorities. Apparently, in the early American colonial settlers, when they were going to find a new place to build a settlement, they would arrive there. They go, right, this is where we're going to settle, okay? No more traveling about in tents and wagons and everything like that. This is where we're going to stop and we're going to build a village, a town, hopefully one day a city. And what many of them did first was when they arrived, they go, right, this is where we're going to settle. Scottish Presbyterians, apparently, so they were serious people. And the first thing they would do is build a place of worship. And after the place of worship was built, they would build their homes. Right, first of all, we need to claim this land for God. And then we will build our homes. And to be part of the covenant of grace means that our settlement, our settling, wherever we settle, not just physically, but wherever we settle spiritually, has to be settled first by an understanding of worship and a place of worship and an attitude of worship. And to be this pilgrim that goes into the world separate from the world, but a blessing to the world. And to say, first and foremost is God. And for all his many faults, and we'll see he had many faults, Abraham believed this. And you know, as we go further into the account of the life of Abraham, we'll see promises that God made to him about his offspring and his posterity and promises made regarding the nations. And we'll touch on how those are fulfilled in the Lord Jesus Christ, the mediator of the new covenant. But the new covenant and the New Testament began the Old Covenant, the Old Testament, and that began here with this work of Abraham. Let's pray.